Hello and welcome to Changing the Record, the podcast brought to you by the Talking About My Generation news team, who are setting the record straight on growing older in Greater Manchester.
Welcome to another podcast in the series of A Cuppa with Carol. And this week I'm chatting to Colin Unsworth from Forest Horizons. Hi, Colin. Thank you for joining me today.
Hello, Carol. You all right?
Yeah, not so bad. Would you like to tell us a little bit about you personally and a little bit about what you do?
Oh, yeah. How personal do you want?
Well, I have seen photos of the naked bike ride in Manchester.
Well, it didn't take long to get that out, did it? So, yeah.
Is that what they said to you?
That is something that I do, so because that's a good laugh. But, I'm a dad of two adults. And I am a woodworker, and I used to teach at the college in joinery, wood machining and what have you, and I do all traditional joinery and stuff. But my hobby and passion that's turned into something that I do as part of my career is wild food foraging. Yeah.
Okie doke. So is it all about sort of living off the land kind of thing, or is it a nature element to that as well?
Yeah, it's a funny one, because people sort of say, where did you start? And I have no idea. I've kind of always liked, you know, like basically, I liked playing out when I was a kid. And I think as an adult, we just love to carry on playing out, don't we?
Well, that's true. I mean, do you think the pandemic's had an effect on people and nature?
Yeah, these nature connections are often sort of sparked within us. They're kindled within us when we're kids and we play out and we might play in the woods or we might play on that little bit of wasteland at the end of the street or whatever it is. And then some of us go to scouts or something like that. Or in school, you might have a nature table or, you know, something that inspires you. Obviously, you've got all the programmes on telly over our lifetimes, like with the Attenborough stuff that inspires you about nature. And then as a fully fledged adult, how do you keep up that connection? Do you forget about that connection? Because the world that we live in kind of teaches us that the valuable things are not in nature connections. The valuable things are like getting, you know, into the city and going to work and being a steady wage earner and having a good car and all that sort of stuff. But the pandemic, it's really interesting you should ask about the pandemic, because I think the pandemic has made everybody kind of stop and just slow down and take stock and think, actually, what is it that's important to me? You know, what is it that is giving me the quality of life? It doesn't matter. You know, we used to talk about standards of living quite a lot during the 80s, didn't we? And you'd measure standards of living by how many appliances you've got and what your wage is and all this sort of stuff. But there's a quality of life as well, isn't there? And what is it that gives you quality of life? And I think a lot of people have just remembered just the value of what it is to just go on a little walk. Yeah. Because I get autumn hay fever. I don't suffer with hay fever until the autumn. And when I got into mushroom foraging, one of the things I discovered is that autumn hay fever is usually due to the fact there's a lot more mushroom spores in the air. So I'm looking foraging, but it's almost like I've got a little radar. So I start sneezing and something inside my head goes, oh, I must look for those bleak mushrooms up in such and such a woods. And the radar's kicked in.
I used to go mushrooming with my dad, like you're saying, when I was a kid. He used to take us and show us the fairy rings and sort of how to find the mushrooms. And like you say, there's this sort of disconnect as you get older. I knew all the names of the wild flowers around us, you know, all the nicknames and things. And yet probably now I'd be really pushed, you know, to name anything. But I think one thing for people who don't forage regularly, if you like, I mean, I'm sure people ask you all the time, how do you know what's safe, I guess?
Yeah, there's no shortcut to that, I'm afraid. It's just a case of finding out, reading about it, knowing it, learning about it. And basically, once you know that particular species, whatever it is, plant, tree, berry, mushroom, you know, whatever it is, once you know it, you know it. So people kind of look for shortcuts with like general edibility rules. You know, I've heard that mushrooms that grow on wood are not edible, and I've heard that mushrooms that do this are edible. If anybody ever tells you any general edibility rule, don't listen to it, because there's always exceptions to it. They just don't work. The general edibility rules don't work. There are general edibility rules once you've become familiar with the different families of mushrooms. So once you know that you've got an agaricus mushroom, you can apply certain rules to whether or not it's an edible agaricus. You're same with the bleat, same with, you know. So there are, but in terms of general edibility rules, no, there are none. You've just got to learn it. It's the hard way. But I've got to say, learning, for me, everybody has a different learning style, don't they? People learn in different ways. As a teacher, I kind of know this. It's no good me saying, oh, this is the best way to learn, just because it worked for me, because it might not work for you or somebody else, because we've all got different minds, haven't we? So the way that works for some people is they just get their nose into a book and they just read and read and read and read and they read all that stuff. I'm not as good at that. I do love my books and I will research stuff, but that's not the thing that kind of fires information into my head and makes it stay there. The thing that I like is interacting with people. So I talk to people. I used to go out and pay people people to go on forages. That's how I did a lot of my learning, by being a forage participant. But these days, we've got social media, and social media is, you know, for all its ills and for all the things we criticise it for, it's got some fabulous aspects to it, which is about connections, communities and stuff like that. And wild food foraging is superb because, you know, you see something, you take a few good identification pictures of it, you learn a bit about how to pose a question about the identification of the species, or a bit about the habitat, you know, a few good pictures showing different angles. And there's like thousands and thousands of people out there to draw information from, and they're all willing to help because everybody loves sharing information, don't they, because we're human beings, you know.
I must admit, I've got an app. I've got an app for that. Not for mushrooms particularly, but I have got a flower plant identification app, which I must admit I have used and I found very effective.
I use a plant app. I do use a plant app. I don't know every single plant out there, so I do use a plant app. But as far as those apps go, use a plant app. Do not use a mushroom app. across all the social media mushroom groups, I run the largest mushroom foraging Facebook group, Mushroom Spotters UK. And there's a few big, you know, there's even bigger ones that are like US groups and stuff. And there's just an absolute general thing out there, which is plant apps are getting to the point where they're pretty good and quite reliable. Never trust one source. So if your plant app says, this is what plant it is and it's edible, don't just trust that. Cross-reference to your books, to the internet, to everything else. The mushroom apps are shockingly, scarily wrong often. Every single year, we get somebody who, just out of curiosity, has pointed a mushroom app at a death cap mushroom just to see what it says. Will it come up and tell me it's a death cap? And the mushroom app has told them it's a porcini.
Right.
Now, from an edibility point of view, you couldn't get it more wrong there, could you?
Well, no, and I suppose that prompts me to ask you the obvious question. Have you ever made a mistake?
Yeah, I have misidentified mushrooms and thought it was something else when it was something else, and then discovered late, but never with one that I've eaten. If you're a mathematician, switch off now because you'll hate what I'm about to say, unless you're like 500% certain. You know, I know there's no such thing. But it's like, you've got to be so, you know, it's not just that I know that this is the right species. You've got to know it on a different level, because you just wouldn't take that risk. Not that there's that many deadly poisonous species, but even just a night, you know, there's one mushroom which we call the poison pie. The mushroom names are fantastic, so you can guess whether the poison pie is edible or poisonous. No, not deadly, but if you was to eat one of them, well, its Chinese name, translation of the Chinese name, is the two-headed dragon. And the reason for that is because it turns you into the two-headed dragon, as in from both ends.
Oh, no.
You know, so that's just not something that you'd ever want to risk, is it, just for a meal? You know what I mean? A meal's not worth that, you know?
Well, no. So with the fungi, I mean, this time of the year, is this a good time for foraging?
Absolutely fantastic. Yeah, but don't look at your calendar and record the date, because the seasons do not follow our calendar, do they? So you've just got to wait for the season to hit. Last year, we were waiting until quite far into September before the season hit. I always start running forages late August and then into September and into October. It's just a fingers crossed thing that the season starts at the end of August and it runs all the way through to the end of October. Fingers crossed, because that's kind of when autumn is. But last year, it didn't really start till it was almost October before we got into the autumn fungi was coming out. This year, it's absolutely on cue. We've had all this rain. I know it's still warm, but there's an abundance going on at the moment. So yesterday we were picking porcini up near Tockholes. I had a forage up there and we got a full table full of mushrooms and we had a big fry up and everybody had a butty and we got a lot of different species. Yeah.
Right. Obviously, I guess there are places that you know they're going to come. Do you have to protect your patch yam?
You know, that's a really difficult one, because as a wild food forager running courses, what I do constantly is go around the country giving all my patches away and showing people where they are, or people can identify mushrooms. I'm not too precious about it, to be honest. Some people get really, really precious about it. I wouldn't go posting online where my best porcini spots are, because that'd just be a bit daft. But I'm not too precious about it, because the chances, even if I do, you know, a course every year in the same spot and show people a porcini patch, the chances of them going back on the same day that I go, you know, and mushrooms do pop up quite quickly. So if, you know, if somebody else has gone to the patch 3 days before me, I might not even know about it, you know, because all the ones have popped up or whatever, you know. So I don't get too worried about it. There is a bit of a thing about over foraging. People worry about over foraging. You know, are you picking too many? Are you going to sort of strip the forest bare and all that sort of stuff? But all the research up to now that's been done into this, and all the collective sort of knowledge from all experienced foragers and scientists and everybody, and looking at places like countries in Eastern Europe where foraging is very, very popular pastime, it doesn't harm the organisms and it doesn't stop the mushrooms popping up. Studies are a bit inconclusive, but if anything, they lean towards the fungi fruits even more if it's foraged more, you know. So
I suppose is it like sort of animals eating it, I suppose?
Yeah. And we're just another animal, you know. So some people sort of go, well, we should leave nature alone. And you sort of think, how on earth can we leave nature? We are part of nature. We're another creature living on the planet, and there's a lot of us. And if I leave nature alone, that's just over there outside my window, and I think, oh, don't touch that. Well, what bit of nature am I sort of impacting on? Because there's another bit somewhere else that's been impacted in order to get my food to the supermarket and all that sort of stuff. You know, each and every one of us has to have an impact on the planet. So if we can learn about our connections, if we can learn about how that bit of nature, that bit of woodland that's on our doorstep is all working, how the fungi connects the trees, how the tree species are working with each other, how the plants like to live in certain habitats and how it all works, then we're going to get a better understanding of our role on the planet, aren't we? It's nothing but positivity, you know.
And a good breakfast.
Yeah, a tasty breakfast. You know, a bit of mindfulness and all that sort of stuff. You know, there's real science behind all that woodland therapy and woodland bathing and all that sort of stuff. You know, it's good for you. You're breathing in bacteria that are good for you. So get out there.
Well, I must admit, I always remember how magical it was that, you know, you would go to a field one day and you'd go around the fairy ring, be nothing. And then the next morning, there'd be about a 6-inch across mushroom and the insects will have got to it and eaten half of it. And you think, well, it doesn't seem possible somehow, does it?
No. It's well, you know, they have this habit of popping up like mushrooms.
So this time of year, so what else do you forage for? It's not just mushrooms, I guess. There are other things.
Mushrooms. I love mushrooms because they're quite funky. You know, like if I am waiting for a plant to come up, then they're quite reliable. I know where certain plants grow. They're visible for most of the year. If it's a herbaceous plant and it disappears during the winter, I still kind of know it's going to be there the following year. And the mushrooms are a bit more tricky. So the mushrooms are a bit more like an Easter egg hunt when you were a kid. You know, it's, you go hunting and you get a prize. But there are lots and lots of other things to forage. So in general, I mean, there's mushrooms to forage all year. There's plants to forage all year. There's berries to forage for most of the year, depending on what you're looking for. But in general, mushrooms, the best season is autumn. Spring is all your spring greens, all your plants, all your sort of new plants coming up, your herb type plants coming up, hogweeds and all that sort of stuff. And summer is like a bit of a crossover, plus your berries, you know. So that's the whole thing. Winter, the lean time of year for foragers traditionally, but there's still always stuff to find, you know, and really nice little things as well, you know. So in the middle of winter, there's a mushroom that I would go looking for called a velvet shank. And a velvet shank grows in clusters on the side of a tree, and it's an orange mushroom, a cluster of orange mushrooms on the side of a tree, and they've got like a velvety stipe and a velvety stem, and they will grow right through the deepest, darkest depths of winter. So you can have a snowy scene with this orange cluster growing out the side of a tree, and its Latin name is velatypes, as in it's got a velvet stipe, but it's a flammalina velatype, so it's a little flame, flammalina, which is really nice, isn't it?
Yeah. And I actually think it looks quite amazing, you know,
They look pretty. And then just having that name gives you a little bit of a sort of a little bit of a glow inside. You just go, oh, little flammalinas, you know. And traditionally, before, you know, the Christmas scene on our Christmas cards is holly and pine trees. But that's not really the traditional image that we've always used. So, you know, in Victorian times, a very, very traditional winter, midwinter scene would have been velvet shanks with ivy.
It's funny because I think I had one of these sort of hedgerow books or something. Do you remember, was it that Country Diary of an Edwardian Lady or something? I don't that was very, very big many moons ago. But I have a feeling that does ring a bell, actually. So this time of the year, I'm guessing there's blackberries, sloes.
Sloes a bit later in the year. Sloes are still ripening up yet. But yeah, blackberries are ready. I'm going to get blackberry tomorrow. There's all sorts of, I mean, I'm going to talk about mushrooms, aren't I? There's mushrooms coming up, you know, there's all the bleak coming up. The bleak mushrooms is the family of mushrooms that contains the porcini, so they're all coming up, which is a very exciting time of year. You've got, if we just went for a walk, I'd just stop every 2 seconds. Look at that. It might be, you know, they've still got the nuts inside. It might be little deceiver mushrooms. We've got hogweed has edible shoots in the springtime. And then a bit later on, you get the florets, which kind of are all curled up and it's like a little mini broccoli, and they're incredibly tasty. And then at this time of year, you get the seed heads have all matured and ripened. And the seed heads of a common hogweed plant, you have to taste it to believe it, because it blows your mind, the flavour. It's really, really powerful flavour. So it's not something you'd use as an ingredient. You'd use it almost as a spice. It's as powerful as a cardamom pod, you know.
Oh, wow. well, I probably wouldn't know a hogweed if I fell over one, but I will go and look it up.
Yeah, and as with most things that you forage out there, you just need to know what it is you're foraging. Although it's very easy to tell the difference. The one that you wouldn't want to use is the common hogweed, which is the same family as hemlock, the most poisonous plant, so you don't want to mistake it for that. But it's quite easy to identify and tell the difference between hogweed and hemlock. But the thing that you could mistake it for is giant hogweed, and you don't want to be consuming giant hogweed. You don't even want to touch it too much. If you was to break apart any part of a giant hogweed plant and get some of the sap on your skin on a sunny day, it has to be on a sunny day. If it's a cloudy day, you might just escape it, but on a sunny day, it causes a reaction with the sunlight and it burns you basically. It can be severe, like third degree type burns, big blisters on you. If you get a lot of it up your arms, across, you know, there was two lads in Farnworth a few years ago who chopped the stems and they're using them as lightsabers and they got covered in this stuff and it was on a sunny day. You're talking life changing injuries. And it's not just burns that you recover from. You don't recover from it because it means that that part of your skin where you've had those burns and those blisters remains photoreactive for the rest of your life. So you can't go out in the sun for the rest of your life, otherwise it burns you. It's pretty serious stuff. And obviously you don't want to go eating that chemical.
Every year I think we get warnings about it, don't we? And, you know, when you're going out to country parks. Because now, are they doing all these balsam beating as well? Is that...
Yeah, getting rid of all the Himalayan balsam. I mean, that's something that you can eat. The whole plant's edible, by the way, balsam. The leaves are edible, the flowers are edible. The flowers make little pretty toppings for a salad, you know. And the seeds are especially tasty. I once made some flapples with chickpeas and balsam seeds, and that was really tasty. So another thing you can do with Himalayan balsam for kids' parties. So, you know, our drinking straws are a problem environmentally, you know, with bits of plastic getting chucked away, single-use plastic and stuff. So go to a big Himalayan balsam patch with a knife and chop a load of it down. And what you do with the stem is the stem kind of has about a 10-inch long section and then a knuckle and then a 10-inch long section and a knuckle. And if you chop those knuckles off and give yourself that 10-inch section, it's hollow and you can use it as a drinking straw. So if kids chew on it, it's fine because it's edible. And then you can use it as a drinking straw or a pea shooter if you're inventive. And then put it in the compost afterwards.
Oh, well, that's a good tip. I must admit, we had a lot of balsam when I was a child, but I just used to love popping the seeds.
You can see this, it's a fantastic evolutionary design, isn't it? You know?
And you used to hear them as you walk past them. If you touch them in the slightest, this is sort of ping and the scattering of the seeds. It was funny, you'd mentioned beech mast earlier, and I was only talking about that today. We have a large tree round the corner here at the Sea Cadets, and I was only commenting that the ground isn't completely covered this year. Is it still early, or is it a bad year for it?
It all depends, basically. Beech trees seem to kind of produce a good nut, you know, like because the mast is basically a husk, isn't it? And sometimes a husk is empty. So it produces a good nut about once every 3 years.
Uh-huh.
So you've kind of just got to go walking around and find a tree that's producing this year. Even then, the nuts are very small and very flimsy, and I don't really know if it's worth it because quite often the squirrels have beat you to it. And, you know, I've never really successfully got myself a load of beech that was worth having, if you know what I mean. It's a bit different with chestnut, with sweet chestnut. If you find yourself a good sweet chestnut tree, then that's kind of worth looking for. And even then, you want the bigger sweet chestnuts. You don't want the little fiddly one.
Not to be confused with the horse chestnut, I assume.
No, that's slightly toxic.
Yeah, that's fine for playing conkers, but you don't really want to be eating them.
Yeah.
Are there actually that many of them out in the wild?
Sweet chestnuts? No, and yeah, it depends where you are. So sweet chestnuts have more often than not been planted at some point or other. They're not a tree that you find that often in this country and in these climates, just sort of self-seeding across the woodlands and stuff. Other species have competed better with them. They are, interestingly, being planted down south as a replacement for woodworkers. So ash, you know, with the ash dieback disease, we're basically losing the ash species, which is a massive, massive loss. And woodworkers in particular are going to lament the loss of ash. And down south, they're planting sweet chestnut to replace it. So the future woodworkers have got some decent timber to work with. And that basically is due to climate change because down south, we're getting decent climates for growing decent sweet chestnut trees, you know. So whether climate change carries on warming up and we see a lot of sweet chestnut being planted up here soon, I don't know. But the sweet chestnut trees, you find that are big, mature ones. They take generations to mature properly. And what you tend to find is it'll be some big home, some big family house, like a stately home or a big, you know, sort of estate of some family or other from a couple of hundred years ago. And the sweet chestnut trees were planted not for the homeowners, but for their like grandchildren when they grow up. So if you find sweet chestnut trees, I was doing some work in the middle of Moston, Manchester, and there was just two really grand sweet chestnut trees, like a lot of flats behind them. And I'm looking, thinking, what are they doing here? Why is this too big? And the more I look, the more I realise from the lay of the land that before them flat, there was a great big house there. So there must have been some very sort of influential local family lived there for a few hundred years, you know, and it's interesting where you get sweet chestnuts. When you get a lot of sweet chestnut trees, you'll often find they're in conjunction with some nice big home that belonged to some important family or other.
I was watching something the other day about ornamental cherries, and they were saying that, I think it was Michael Portillo maybe, was visiting a home, and this gentleman had imported all these different cherry trees from Japan and around his estate because he liked them. And he'd accidentally, as it were, imported a white cherry, and it's extinct in Japan. And so they sent them back, and they tried a couple of times and it didn't work. They died en route. So they just stick them into potatoes. Then they managed to reintroduce it in Japan as a result of this gentleman in England who was just doing it because he liked cherry blossom. But apparently all the cherry blossom in the UK has come from his stock.
Oh, that's amazing.
I think it's in Sussex somewhere, maybe. It's amazing what you find out, isn't it?
It's amazing how some person, just because they've got the space and the wealth to do it, their little hobby becomes something so important, you know.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, I mean, Kew Gardens has a massive seed bank, doesn't it?
I think it's really important, you know, because one of the things that you start, you know, sort of learning about and becoming more and more conscious of when you get all these nature connections is just how much the planet is destabilizing, just how much of a worry it is, you know, about our future and climate change and all that sort of stuff. We kind of look at the weather forecast as if that's the indicator of climate change and whether or not we're going to get like more sunny days on our beach holiday. Is that climate change? But when you start doing a bit of foraging and you're out there in nature waiting for the different species to turn up and noticing when they're turning up and things going crazily out of season at the moment, you know, so winter mushrooms appearing in the middle of summer and summer mushrooms that don't really go away and carry on fruiting all year, and there's things going on that are quite worrying.
Because there's a lot of symbiosis, isn't there, with tree roots and the fungus. It's all interconnected, isn't it?
It absolutely is. So the botanists at Kew Gardens and the mycologists at Kew Gardens have recently kind of published their findings that they reckon that 96% of plant life, so that's plant trees, you know, the lot, 96% of plant life has a mycorrhizal fungi attached to it. And the mycorrhizal fungi's sort of purpose is to try and sort of have it's like a symbiotic relationship, so they'll help nutrient transfer. So if 96% of plant life has a mycorrhizal attachment to it, then that kind of tells us that mushrooms are not just common. Mushrooms are not just good for the trees. They're actually essential. The, you know, apparent life on Earth, the greening of the planet, as they call it, when plant life first came out of the sea to try and colonise a land, it simply wouldn't have happened if it weren't for the mycorrhizal fungi that evolved with it. The mycorrhizal fungi made it possible. So they enable nutrient transfer. One of the things that they'll do, so the mycorrhizal fungi wraps around the network of roots of a tree, and we've all heard about this thing where they wrap around the network of roots and might connect a few different trees together with that network and pass information between those trees, which is true, that's what happens. But another thing that has been discovered fairly recently is that some of those mycorrhizal fungi, they actually penetrate the roots. So we've known that for ages, that they penetrate the roots, but they penetrate the roots, they penetrate the cells. They actually reprogram the DNA of the tree. So they actually tweak the DNA of the tree in order to make that particular tree more suitable for its particular habitat right here on this banking with a slope like this and a bit of rainfall like that. Now, you say that to people and they kind of go, oh, that's interesting. You say it to a biologist who hasn't had this information recently, you know, who's trained like 10 years ago, and they go, yeah, that's impossible. That can't happen. Things can't have the DNA reprogrammed, but apparently it does happen. It is just it's just mind-blowing. You know, we think that we're some sort of dominant species and we're in charge of the planet and all that. We're not.
I must admit, I was quite blown away. I mean, honest, the fact that, you know, trees send messages to each other, you know, when insects start to attack them, they start producing chemicals that will make the leaves unpleasant.
The initial study that was done into that was plants rather than trees, and that was, they got some raised beds with broad beans. So it was raised beds of broad beans. So you'd have a raised bed of broad bean with no mycorrhizal fungi in the soil and all hermetically controlled environment and all that, and a raised bed that was all impregnated with mycorrhizal fungi, and introduce a black fly attack at one end of the raised bed. So what happens is, the plant then produces an enzyme to pot off the black fly. The plant next to it also produces the enzyme because it's managing to receive that message because the roots are touching, they're brushing against each other, so it is managing to transfer that message. But at the other end of the raised bed, those plants have no idea what's coming to them. Well, you do the same on the mycorrhizal raised bed and you introduce a black fly at one end and the whole bed at one go goes enzymes. So it really is like a communication network, you know, and that can spread across a whole forest. So the biggest organism that we know of in the whole of history of life on Earth is a mushroom, and it's a honey fungus in Oregon. And they, through DNA testing, discovered that it wasn't just the same species they were looking at through the forest. It was the same organism. It was a single organism, 25 kilometers across.
Wow.
So if you think, now the honey fungus isn't a mycorrhizal fungi, it's a parasitic fungi. But if you think of like these mycorrhizal fungi and the ability to grow to them to these kind of sizes and then all interconnect and communicate with each other, and they're kind of controlling what's going on and helping things to survive, or sometimes deciding that things don't survive. That's what the honey fungus does. It honey fungus, like a ruthless gardener, just takes out the dead things and it just sort of marches its way through the forest. Anything that's like not in its pristine condition, it's gone. And then it makes room for the life. So it makes sure the forest is in tip top pristine condition all the time. And
survival then of the fittest.
Yeah, and then we come along. Well, you've got survival of the fittest going on, and then you've got all sorts of communication and cooperation going on, because, sort of said, it was all survival of the fittest, dog eat dog. We should base our society on that, dog eat dog, survival of the fittest. You know, if you're not up to it, you're off. But a modern day biologist and zoologist and whatever will tell us that actually it's communication and cooperation more than survival of the fittest. So you get the survival of the fittest, plus you get the communication cooperation, you get the forest being managed in this way by all the organisms operating together. And then we come along and go, oh yeah, I'm into forest management. It's not us.
I know, and then plant lovely straight lines.
Yeah. And then what we've discovered over the years is that all that type of forest, because a lot of forestry commissions and forestry, you know, organisations these days don't plant like that because they've realised it doesn't work. And the reason it doesn't work is if you plant all monospecies, all in straight lines, they're all the same age, then something comes along and it causes them all to have a particular weakness that year and the whole forest is threatened. Mm-hmm. You know, all of a sudden the honey fungus is taking out a massive sort of whole forest rather than just one tree here and there, you know. So very purposefully, they plant a variety of species these days because you create a healthier forest that way.
And so just returning to the general foraging, do you find that you find more interesting things within a sort of woody or forest environment, or do you find much in open land?
Yeah, different habitats. I mean, if I take a group of people out on a forage, it's great to have a different habitat. So we might walk across a little bit of moorland and then down into the woods. In the woods, we might get different habitats within the woods. So sometimes you get more pine, sometimes you get more birch, sometimes you get more beech, some beech, sometimes it's mixed. And the different habitats will host different species. So for the real prize edible mushrooms, I want a real ancient feeling old woodland with this very mixed ash, beech, birch, oak and pine and many other species mixed in with it. And then I'm going to get all my, you know, my really good edibles. But even without that, even in other woodlands, I will get maybe just not quite the same variety of mushrooms, but there will be fungi coming up. So, like, I'm just thinking around Bolton, Moses Gate Country Park, that's a very new woodland, isn't it? So there's nothing ancient about that. And I'm not really ever expecting to find a porcini in my lifetime down there. But I have foraged plenty of edible stuff down there, you know, so other edible species. And then out on the moors, so you get all your wax caps. You don't get them so much in the woods at all. So you get all your wax caps. So if I was to go up Rivington, you know, the fields at the bottom of the hillside woodlands, there's some fantastic habitats for wax caps. And the wax caps, the meadow wax cap is a really good edible. But even the other wax caps, even though they don't really, they're all edible, but they're not the best edible thing to be putting them on. But they do call them the orchids of the mushroom world because they are so pretty and colourful and vibrant. And you get all these mad colours, greens and yellows and pinks and all sorts, you know. Yeah, there's interesting stuff wherever you go. Not even in nature. Even in the middle of the city, it's amazing what you find. I was in the middle of Budapest a couple of years ago, in the middle of winter, in the middle of Budapest. And you know the velvet shanks, the flammolina that I talked about? Next to St. Paul's Basilica, the big cathedral in the middle of Budapest, there's a tree with them growing out of it.
Right. Wow.
So it kind of doesn't matter where you are. Nature's there, you know.
Well, I know you forage around Bolton area. Do you get around a bit, Colin?
I do get around a bit. Yeah, I do get around a bit. I'm notorious. So mainly around Bolton, just because that's where I am. But like my forages that I'm leading this season, I've got one in Leicester. I've got one up in the northeast in a couple of weeks' time. Next week, I've got Bolton Food and Drink Festival at Queen's Park doing about 6 forages over the bank holiday weekend, just to see what we can find and kind of get people inspired. I've got a few down in the Peak District booked. So I try and get around. Basically, I'm a self-employed person, and the mushroom season is the season when I've got to get in as many forages as I can, because I've got to make that bank balance do something, you know. But it's not so fun. It's so much fun, and I meet so many really, really good people who love to be inspired by it all. And we have a great format, because what I do is I start the forage with gin. So, you know, yeah, you know, people run courses, and if you go on like a training course to be a course leader, whatever the subject that is you're teaching, and they'll always have a section on like icebreakers. And what do you do for your icebreakers? And I was, so I said, well, I get them all drunk. I don't really. What we do is I take a load of gins that I've made myself from all foraged ingredients. So some mushroom gins, believe it or not, some wild flavored mushroom gins, and berry gins. So you get, you know, medicinal mushrooms with very bitter flavors. And when I say bitter, some of them are good bitter flavors, and some of them are not. Right up to the really sweet stuff, like your slow gins and your cherry gins and Gultheria, which is a Rivington berry, particular to Rivington. It's beautiful berry. It's a really complex flavor. Now, we start off by just having a little taste of each, just to kind of whet people's appetites, you know, and it breaks the ice a bit, and then we all go and walk it off, and it's absolutely fine. Nobody's drunk. It's a really good format.
And obviously, it's not just about foraging. It's not just about food as such, is it? You look at wildlife and other plant life as well, don't you?
Basically, whatever's there that we can see. And it's also sometimes about what use to us does it all have, and really, even really simple stuff. So, you know, hazel. So everybody gets a hazel walking staff. So we look at hazel tree and, like, you know, have a look at, you know, because the very simplest is a hazel walking staff. But if you was to take it a bit further, we can start making like chair legs and stuff like that and turn it into furniture. A nice little thing probably that you've seen before is the whistles, isn't it?
Oh, that's right. Yes, your whistles. Infamous whistles.
Yeah, that one didn't work. There we go. And that's made
of whittling.
So we can whittle a whistle out of hazel or any material, actually, and just start to get a bit of an understanding as to how we are actually connected with the woodland on our doorsteps. We're not sort of somehow detached from it. You get all this understanding, and you go for a walk in the woods, and it's a bit different, because instead of just feeling like you're going for a walk in somewhere that's nice, you start to feel like you are part of something nice.
And like you say, it's sort of taking you back to that sort of inner child, really, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And you start to feel a bit like you notice the seasons a bit more. When you're a forager, during lockdown, we all went for local walks, and those local walks were quite fascinating. We all discovered little bits of woodland that we never knew was there and we'd never really appreciated before. But the longer it goes on, the more it's like, oh, it's same old walk. We're just doing that same old walk again. Same old walk again. Well, when you become a forager, you start to just see the very slow but steady passage of the seasons, and that walk's different every single time that you do it, because something else has come up, so there's something else to identify, something else to look at, you know, and you just start to feel really connected, not just with your environment, not just with the nature, but with the passage of the seasons and just the way that the world works and the way the world turns. There's something really nice about it.
Well, it's been absolutely lovely speaking to you, really fascinating. And, you know, your passion for nature sort of shines through. How would people get in touch with you if they wanted to know more, or they wanted to book a session with you or whatever?
Yeah, this is where I do my marketing, but anyway, I'm rubbish at marketing. I talk about this all the time, I'm rubbish at self-promotion. So, yeah, so my thing is Forest Horizons. So you'll find me on Facebook. You will find me on the internet, but do forgive my website. It's so outdated. But if you do find my website, it's foresthorizons.co.uk. You will see a video on there, and that was when I was on Gardener's World. My moment of fame, and I got 7 minutes from Gardener's World. Oh, Rivington, talking about mushrooms. It's a nice, interesting little clip, actually, that I'm very proud of. But I have a Facebook presence, and probably quite an outdated Instagram presence, but definitely Facebook presence, Forest Horizons, and the events are listed under there.
I hope the forages go really well and you find lots of exciting stuff.
The last one is, if anybody does, curiosity's peaked about mushrooms, then connect with Mushroom Spotters UK on Facebook. It's my group, and there's 50,000 members, and you can go on there and you can post a picture of your mushroom and say, can anybody please help me identify this, and you'll get tips and all that stuff, and people will help to identify. It's a brilliant hive mind, you know.
Okay, well, that's really useful. So people's appetite has been whetted, as it were, and they're fancying a mushroom butty somewhere along the line. Hopefully they'll bob in and see what you've been up to. But like I say, it's been fascinating talking to you, and thanks very much for taking the time.
My pleasure. Thank you very much. See you later.
Thank you for listening to our latest edition of the Changing the Record podcast. For all previous episodes and for the latest news, views and nostalgia for Greater Manchester, check out our website talkingaboutmygeneration.co.uk.